And turn things over to your session moderator, Cindy Frickle, from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. Cindy?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
We can.
All right. Thanks, team. So today we will enjoy presentations from Mike Truex of Pacific Northwest National Laboratories and also Mark Bricka from Mississippi State University. So I just want to give you some background on the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable. The FRTR was established in 1990 to build a collaborative atmosphere between federal cleanup program managers and other remediation community representatives. FRTR's primary goals are to share information and learn about technology-related efforts of mutual interest, discuss future directions of the national site remediation programs and their impact on the technology market, interact with similar state and private industry technology development programs, and to form partnerships to pursue subjects of mutual interest. The FRTR's member agencies include the U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Interior, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, National Institutes of Health, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Today's webinar features speakers from the most recent general meeting of FRTR, sponsored by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and was held at the NRC headquarters in Rockville, Maryland this last November. The meeting's topic was remediation technologies for radionuclides and heavy metals in soil, groundwater, and sediments. And the meeting's objectives are listed on your screen. Identify and discuss existing and new innovative remediation technologies with their technical bases, and to share experiences and lessons learned in the application of these technologies. So after, I think at this point I am handing it back over to Jean.
All right, thank you so very much. So we're going to start with our very first presentation today. Our first speaker will be Professor Mark Bricka, who's coming to you from Mississippi State. Mark, if you are on the lines, please feel free to take yourself off of mute and begin.
Okay, I'm assuming everyone can hear me, correct?
We can.
Okay. I've got a presentation that's really an overview. It says heavy metals and soil and water, but tried to cover most of the technology, so we'll talk a little bit about organics also. Anyway, so my presentation is an overview of the technology. Let's see. Okay. First of all, what is environmental remediation? Well, those people with 20 years experience, of course, know this very well. Those that have one may are just getting into it. But really, it's the removal of contaminants from environmental media. I call it environmental media because who knows what you got out there, but basically there's soil, groundwater, surface water. I include sediments because formerly I worked for the U.S. Army Corps, and that was one of their big focuses. But the purpose of this is to take those media and to either remove or stabilize or isolate those contaminants from the environment and prevent them from contaminating the environment overall. So I wanted to go over a few case studies just to bring you up to speed. And I guess one of the more famous sites, at least that I am familiar with, is Rocky Mountain Arsenal. I'm assuming the audience has maybe heard of this or probably run across some technologies used there. But it's a site that the Army actually operated. They made chemical weapons, and then they sublet that to Shell Chemical produced pesticides. So the type of chemical weapons were GB, VX. They had blistering agents too, besides nerve agents, such as Lewisite and mustard. And then Shell made all of those baddies that are on the TCLP list, such as Aldrin and Deodorin, a chemical known as Nemagon to take care of nematodes. And this site was located near the city of Denver. Actually, from the site, you can see Denver. And the old Stapleton Airport actually extended into a part of the facility which we turned over to the airport that was cleaned up. The facility is about 6 miles by 6 miles, so it's a pretty large facility. Covers many acres, and one corner of that site, the northern corner, is shaved off, and Commerce City actually is located down gradient of the facility. The contaminants that were at the facility were everything known to man. You had metals, organics, VOCs, heavies, pesticides, and agent-related compounds, something known as DIMP, which is specific to nerve agent after it's demilitarized. So anyway, the site is fairly large. There's everything known to man out there. It's pretty interesting, at least for environmental remediation. If you were on the lawsuit side, it would keep you busy for years. So some of the areas more notable at Rocky included Basin F, and actually there were basins A through F. Basins A, B, C, D, and E were unlined, and the material that passed through or was stored there disappeared. It basically leached down to groundwater and absorbed into the soil, and so these areas were heavily contaminated. Basin F, which is well known out there in the environmental remediation community, stored a lot of the demilled chemical the Army had, and of course Shell dumped some of their pesticide waste in there, and so it was this quagmire, and since it was lined, it stored this material. There were other places. The South Plants area is actually where they manufactured the munitions. There was also the GB plant where they destroyed the munitions later. So there were many areas, and then they had the lake system out there, which consisted of several lakes. I've got a picture there of the lakes. I'm missing my pointer. Hold on. Where is that? It's not there. But anyway, so we have the lake system, and the technologies they use for remediation, I went back and looked at some history, and I believe some of the first, well, my pointer showed up, some of the first slurry walls that were put in place to maintain contaminants were used out there. I went back and looked, and the North Boundary System was established in the early 80s, late 70s. And the North Boundary System was a slurry wall that where they cut off the water flow, the groundwater flow down to the Commerce City. So they placed that to try to maintain control of the water and keep the contaminants from moving down gradient. Other technologies they had out there were one of the first deep well injections for hazardous materials where they were actually injecting Basin F deep into the strata, and they opened that up in the late 50s, early 60s, and it continued to operate until they had these tremors in Denver, and they tracked it back to the deep well injection. And two things that happened there, they lubricated the fault and pressurized it, so basically Denver started having these tremors, and they EPA said the Army needed to cease and desist from the deep well injection, and that well, I got involved with that a little bit, was closed in the late 90s, all right, the early 90s, excuse me. Another interesting thing we had in Basin F, the waterfowl, and it was a major flyover area for various waterfowl, and so we had ducks that would land on Basin F because it was a beautiful from the air site, because it was a dark black and it reflected the sky and the clouds, so it looked like a great place to a beautiful lake, and the ducks would come in there and would never take off. And so we put these air cannons out to try to control the duck population and keep them away from there. But it made it difficult to work with all those cannons going off all the time. So anyway, and we also had bubonic plague. We had prairie dogs that were everywhere, and these prairie dogs would get the fleas on them, and so we had to be careful about that. So this area was notoriously contaminated, a very large area, etc. So, but then, now it's been changed into a wildlife refuge. There's pristine, not pristine conditions, but wildlife, bald eagles, buffaloes that roam the area, etc. So basically, although there are areas that there was a fence put around and it said do not enter this because of the contamination, most of the site was, at least on the surface, fully remediated to the best of the ability of the technology we had at the time. Another area I wanted to discuss, a case study, was the small arm firing ranges. Some of you may be familiar with this or not, but the military and also private ranges, there's a lot of lead that goes down range. Basically, that's its intended purpose. You take a munition, you shoot it from a rifle or a pistol, and it goes down range, goes through a target, impacts a berm, a safety berm. That berm is made to store that lead, and that's not a waste, at least the way it's worded now. But as soon as contamination or lead leaches off of the area or that you go in to remove that lead, then that becomes a waste and has to be handled. The problem is that many of these areas were politically sensitive, and the military had a knee-jerk reaction. For instance, down in Arizona, Fort Huachuca was one range that basically got the limelight, and they said, all right, go down there and let's develop some technologies and demonstrate them at Huachuca. And I just had some heartache with that when I first was involved with this and said, well, wait a minute. First of all, is that really representative of all of these ranges we have out there? Because we knew we had literally thousands of ranges. And is the desert environment really representative of what we have out there? And two, it's going to be an area that's probably less mobile just because we don't have the water that contacts the material, and it's probably not representative. So what we did is went out, and then I took all of the range data that I had, overlaid it on a map of the U.S., so we were just looking at CONUS facilities, and then I took a soils map, a surface soils map, laid it on top, and we found that really the southeast was our major area where the ranges were located, and we should target those for study. So what we found is when we were doing the studies that indeed we did have a lot of contamination simply from the lead that was fired out there. Here's a picture of a facility, and you can see the lead mat that forms actually on a firing range, so there's literally thousands and thousands of bullets going down range. But at these larger facilities, we can have up to 1,000 lanes at a particular firing lanes at a particular site. So it can be quite a lot of lead that's going down range. But what we found is that not only did we have the particulates, and they are pretty easy to remove with sieving and some physical separation remediation techniques, you can take the bullets out, but due to galvanic corrosion, because the bullet is coated with, or not coated, jacketed with copper, that the difference in the lead and the copper causes the lead to actually become mobile, a plus two phase that migrates into the soil and groundwater and surface water potentially, but really that small fraction of the soil tends to absorb that. And through the absorption, the fines of the material have a larger fraction of this lead, and it becomes mobile simply because of the fact that it can be transported off range. So there's the firing range. So let's get back into remediation technologies. We have really two types of technologies. We've got those ex situ technologies where we need to remove the contaminant and treat that. and the in-situ technologies where we try to leave the contaminant in place in the soil or in the groundwater and treat it there. So, and we've got a number of technologies we can apply to this, and I'm just trying to, I can't talk about them all, but I'm trying to hit some highlights. So there's things like dig and haul, water treatment, biological treatment, phytoremediation, electrokinetics, and many others, but we'll try to highlight a few of these. So the state of development of these technologies, they can be in various states of development. One is we can have existing technologies, for instance, like dig and haul. We've got emerging technologies such as electrokinetics, where it actually has been pilot demonstrated and used at some full sites, but on a limited basis. And then innovative technologies, and the best one I could think of is a biorefinery, where we're actually trying to make products out of a hazardous material or a hazardous waste. So, dig and haul. Everybody that's been out there for years, got any experience, know that basically it's the most used technology. You go out there with some type of excavation equipment. You dig up the contamination. You basically put it in a drop box, and then you have to haul it off, and you usually put that in a landfill or maybe on site on in a solid waste management unit. The problem is that it only transfers the contamination from one location to the other. Hopefully we've done a better job where we placed it than where we dug it up, but you have a long-term liability or the potential for contamination to migrate that continues to remain with the waste. It's relatively low cost, but this depends on many factors out there, and if you're going to apply it depends on many factors. So that's dig and haul. We've got containment, and containment can come in many colors. There's landfills, slurry walls. We talked about that with Rocky. Solidification stabilization, where we actually treat the waste and then try to store it somewhere. And then these that are used by DOE for vitrification, where we turn the material to a glaseous type product. And calcination, where we've taken a liquid waste and, or partially liquid waste and try to make it solid. So landfilling. Those that have been out there in the industry know, but typically, at least for hazardous materials, we've got subtype C and subtype D facility. A D facility is where the municipal waste tends to be carried off, your garbage from your house. Subtype C is actually a hazardous waste that's lined, copiously lined, and monitored, and you've got leachate collection. Although you've got that at D, it's a little bit, it's not as on the same type of steroids as we put the subtitle C facility. Here I've got a landfill showing Cherry Island. It's quite a large landfill, and then over here is the lining construction associated with that, and I'm assuming that many are probably familiar with that. We also put daily cover on each of the lifts as we put material in a landfill so that we don't get fugitive emissions. And then it's capped ultimately when that landfill is filled and a drainage layer is put in there to make sure that we reduce the amount of water infiltration. If you're interested, the EPA had the Corps put together a model called HELPS, and it does a water balance around what would permeate through the landfill, wind up in the leachate versus runoff. It was prepared by an individual I work with. His name is Paul Schroeder, so I can put you in touch if you're interested. Slurry walls, basically what we do here with the slurry wall is you take a backhoe or some type of piece of excavation equipment, you dig a trench, and you place a slurry into that trench. This can be composed of bentonite, clay material. Most of those have very low permeability and are swelling clays. You can also put other additives, but what we're trying to do is simply establish a low permeable zone so that groundwater will not flow through that particular slurry wall. So you see with this particular application they're putting the slurry in, and this is actually keeping the water from this dam passing through to the lower side of the dam. But there's quite a head on that. All right, solidification stabilization. This is I started working on this for EPA under the land ban proposals, and even before that with a study that was called the interference study. And we looked at material that would interfere with stabilization solidification. Basically, what it involves is that you take a pozzolanic or cementitious material with additives, you add it to a semi-slurry or a liquid, and then it becomes a solid. The solidification is the fact that you may form a monolith. Stabilization is where you have a reaction with the contaminants, and the contaminants are no longer mobile because we had maybe a phase change or a speciation change. So you've really got two lines of defense. We can reduce water infiltration if you form a monolith or a block of concrete, if you think of it. That way you've got particles that would be less likely to move. And then you have the chemical stabilization that happens. This can be conducted either in situ or ex situ, and typically lime, fly ash, Portland absorbents are added. But mixing is critical, and a lot of times this is done just with backhoe mixing. It's done in situ, and it's fairly crude. Next is vitrification. Vitrification is a technology where we put electrodes into the ground, potentially add a high voltage current. If it's done in situ, you have to collect the off gas. If you've got volatiles and you form a melt, it actually melts the soil. It forms an obsidian-like material. And the problem is it's primarily used for nuclear waste simply because it's very expensive. It's very impermeable, which is good, but it does have some limited permeability and shelf life, but it's very long. It's energy intensive, and so it's very expensive. Also, the volatile collection system can get quite elaborate, and therefore also increasing the cost. Calcination, it's pretty complex process. I put this up just to show you that there's a lot involved with calcination, and again, it's mostly used for radionuclides. Pump and treat technology. That's besides the stabilization. This is probably one of the number one technologies that's used out there. What you do is put in your slurry wall, or you just put in dewatering wells around your slurry wall, or you don't have to have a slurry wall, and pump out the contaminated groundwater. But then that requires treatment. So you pump it out. It is an in situ, at least for the pumping part. But then the ex situ treatment would involve all of the technologies such as stripping, neutralization, some type of water treatment, membrane treatment, ion exchange, electrochemical type treatment such as electrodialysis or electrophoresis, or flotation, which is a mining type treatment, electrowinning, you got filtration. So you can just throw a number of technologies at that groundwater after you pump it out. Then and I'm focused on electrowinning just because it's a little less known technology, but basically it's just like electroplating. I have my liquid and I'm trying to plate the metal onto the plates, and has to be charged, and so I put a current across there, a DC current, and pull those metals out. Physical separation, we studied this, and it's been studied extensively, and we're really robbing technology from the mining industry. They've been doing this for years. It's just like panning for gold. That's a physical separation technique where you take a water slurry, you slurry the dirt, the heavies fall into the pan, stay there, and you tossed out the lights. But there's more sophisticated ways such as tabling, you have flotation, classification. They got these big spiral separators that look like water slides, and you take your slurry and run it down the water slide, and due to the centrifugal force that's applied, you can actually have separation. Trommels, they're big sieves that rotate, and you can have you can also use magnetic properties of soils to separate those. You can also use density, various liquids with different specific gravities will help separate separate materials physically. The problem is many of these are extremely toxic. I don't know if anybody has experience with that, but it's kind of lost favor due to the toxicity of many of those different density liquids. And then you've got soil flushing or washing, which is intentionally applying some type of extractant into in situ into the groundwater or soil and trying to remove those contaminants and get them out of the soil. Other remediation technologies, heap leaching is one. This is used in the gold mining industry a lot, where they take a cyanide solution, sodium cyanide, they spray it onto large piles of ore, and then basically have a collection system and try to collect the leachate that comes out. Hopefully that's laden with gold or the metal or the contaminant of interest, and then you subsequently have to treat that. We've got phytoremediation. This works for metals and organics. With organics, some of that, it works like a straw where you can have a tree, we'll say, the root system will pump the contaminant up into the leaves, and then it can volatilize out or maybe concentrate into the plant itself. The metals usually stay in the plant. The problem is the plants have to be harvested and then disposed of a lot of times by incineration, and that tends to concentrate the metals in either the fly ash or the bottom's ash, and then that's going to require some type of disposal or treatment. If you put that in a landfill, then you've concentrated that and you've increased the potential for leaching, so kind of chasing your tail. Then you've got supercritical oxidation, supercritical water extraction. So these technologies can actually go in there and extract the contaminant. And then absorption and absorption and adsorption, both of those, I tend to just call them sorption. So you can use sorption technologies to contain that contaminant. There's a newer technology, not newer, but one that's less frequently used, freeze crystallization. You can actually drive your contaminant out of your soil. And then electrokinetics is one of my personal favorites, and I've done a lot of research on that, and we'll talk about that. Okay, electrokinetics is a technology that a lot of times it's targeted for in situ use. That can be used ex situ, but it's less cost effective. And what happens in a normal system, when you pump and treat, you've got clay zones, and of course, that's where your contaminant may be held, and your contaminant will, the water that you're pumping due to hydraulic gradient will move around these clay zones. But with electrokinetics, we get more of a uniform movement through there, and it's really effective in low permeable materials, such as a clay with about 10 to the minus 6 permeability. And the way it works is we have electromigration, which is actually the movement of the metals due to the electrical charge and the charges associated with the metals. You can have electroosmosis, where you can actually move a waterfront through there. And electrophoresis, which is particles, but because it's in soil, they tend to be filtered out. You also get a pH front that you can control. So this is quite effective. If you're extracting metals, you can drive the soil's pH down and then reverse the charge on your electrodes and bring that back to neutrality. One of the interesting things that happened with this technology, it was actually used extensively for the dewatering of dredge material early on by the Corps. And what happened is the leachate that they had, the water during the extraction, was extremely contaminated with metals, and they said, oh my gosh, we don't know what to do with this extractant. And so this is not a viable technology. And it took us about 20 years later to say, hey, we can maybe use that beneficially. So 20 years later, we finally got back into the business of electrokinetic treatment. One of the studies that I am familiar with was out at Point Magoo Naval Weapons Station. There was cadmium chrome that was extensively disposed of into these ponds that you see here. And we did a 6-4 dim valve project for DOD. It also was a site demonstration project. I don't even know if they still have that program, but the Superfund Innovative Technology demonstration, and ESTCP, which many of y'all are familiar with. So all three of those funding mechanisms came in to look at this technology. We went out there and put in this electrokinetic system. You see, we actually had a firm called Lintech that originally operated this, and then later it was taken over by the Corps, and we operated it. And the problem was is that it moved very effectively the chrome and the cadmium out of the pits. But the problem was there was trichloroethylene co-mingled with the contaminant at low levels, but the electrolytically we converted, we dechlorinated the trichloroethylene and wound up with vinyl chloride monomer, which actually was more of a concern in California than the trichloroethylene, so we had to take steps to control the migration of the VC that we produced. Biological treatment is another technology that we can use, and you can do that aerobically or anaerobically. This in situ is a little bit more difficult to control. A lot of it's used with composting, and I've got an example of a composter down there in the lower right you can see. This was actually a windrow system. You also have rotating biological contactors, so there's a variety of ways to try to use biological treatment. I guess the best known is activated sludge. But in the effort, in the emphasis of time, I'll move along. So if we go to apply any one of these remediation technologies, first of all, we've got to have a pretty good site assessment. We're going to have to get the contaminants of concern, some soil characteristics, a lot of the geology, because if you've got pockets of rock and pockets of clay, that's very important, where your groundwater is, et cetera. You've got to consider your cost. And, of course, most of the time we want to have the most cost-effective technology that still benefits the public the best. You've got to look at your regulations. There's many regulations that come into play. Matter of fact, a lot of times they'll just call them ARARs, applicable or appropriate regulations that you must meet. Then you've got the public, and, of course, the public comes up with a not-in-my-backyard syndrome, so a lot of times you go in to remediate an area, and you have to have public hearings to have a, what you're going to do approved, or remedial action boards that are involved. So you need to coordinate up front if possible, and it's terrible to do it on the back. You need to come up and work with your local regulators to get preliminary, primary remediation goals so you know what your targets are, which are very hard to establish, and you have to work closely with the regulators. And then if you're going to have a clean closure, you need to establish what you've got involved with your clean closure. So, in summary, we've got many technologies, and we've got some good success stories. I showed you Rocky Mountain Arsenal. Here's another mining site, and it was extremely contaminated due to the fact of the mining operations, and we basically, the site was destroyed due to acid mine drainage. You impacted the stream, and then you can see it after they had closure and some of the remediation efforts. And then here's another site. I'm a little bit more familiar with this one. This is the Climax mine site. It's located, if you've ever been skiing up near Breckenridge, it's up in Leadville, and it's on the Continental Divide. And they mined molybdenum at the Climax mine. What it's known for, mostly active in World War II, but they recently reactivated the mine. It's on the Continental Divide, so you've got the water that divides to the Atlantic and the Pacific sides. This is actually shows the acid mine drainage and how it impacted the Pacific drainage area, and this is after they remediated it. And so they reestablished vegetation and the site's nice and great and stuff now. So anyway, that concludes really an overview of some technology. Hopefully you weren't too bored, and I guess if there's questions, I'll be glad to address those. So turn it back to the moderator.
All right. Thank you so very much, Professor Bricca. I just want to remind the audience, if you have questions or comments for our speaker, you can submit them electronically using the Q&A window in the bottom right corner of your screen at any time. I know a few of you have sent some questions in, so we'll certainly pause right now to read through those questions and have our speaker, pardon me, address them live. I just wanted to check in with Cindy and make sure that it's okay if I start with some of those online questions.
Yes, please do.
All right. So, Professor Bricca, the first question asks if there are differences between lead remediation for inorganic lead, such as those that you might see at a small arms range, and then the organic lead from an old gasoline release.
Well, that organic lead that you're referring to actually is added is a, what is the formula? It's a bromine lead complex that forms. So lead in itself, is it organic or not organic? It depends, and the species can change back and forth depending on the redox potential to the soil, what kind of pH you have, what kind of little wigglies down there will convert it. But basically, if you can get the lead and form a plus two, a lot of times any of these technologies I talked about will target that lead, all right? The organic lead can be easily oxidized into an inorganic form, typically. I hope that addresses your question.
All right, thank you so much. Our next question gets into phytoremediation, and it's sort of more of a comment, but I'm wondering if you can respond to this comment. So the attendee states that phytoremediation seems to have lost favor lately, other than perhaps providing cover to be able to grow at elevated concentrations, and that it's not actually being used for removing the heavy metals from the soils. Can you talk about that concept?
Well, since I moved from the Army to academia, I've become a little less directly involved with some of the cleanup activities. But I do know that phyto remediation for lead was being used at many mining smeltering sites. They were putting brassica, Indian mustard out there. It seemed to hyper-accumulate that and harvested. I'm assuming that some of that work still is occurring, but due to the fact that you still must do something with the plants after you accumulate it, you know, that's the drawback to phytoremediation. It makes great cover, but when I say phytoremediation, I'm actually talking about the contaminant moving into the plant and not just the plant keeping soil erosion from occurring. So I agree and disagree.
Okay. All right, excellent. Thank you. The next question is probably, it might be hard to answer, but I'll toss it out there. They want to know if one of these technologies is considered more cost-effective for heavy metals, and if so, which one?
Well, of course, digging holes is the most cost-effective because in a lot of cases you're still having to put the residual into a landfill. So if you don't treat it and put it in a landfill, that's always more cost-effective. But you really need to look at a life cycle analysis to figure out the cost, because in many cases we have to haul it a number of miles. You start looking at your fuel use, you start looking at the environmental impact due to large trucks on the road, the impact on the road, the fact that you're going to have to repave, and the money associated with that. So if you don't look at all the costs involved with a technology, sometimes it appears cheaper. So I will just answer your question by saying it depends.
Got it. All right. And then you gave an example of a site where a technology was brought in to address heavy metals, but it wound up adding in a layer of complexity because they had other contaminants of concerns on site. So this participant is sort of hitting home at that idea. Do you often see these technologies combined with others to address a range of contaminants of concern? If so, is one of these technologies sort of better armed to be able to deal with things, more contaminants of concern other than heavy metals? So something perhaps more flexible of the list that you provided to deal with a range of contaminant of concerns?
I can actually say that when I first started in the remediation area, organics were the target of concern typically. A lot of times you would apply a technology that would treat the organics, and sometimes it would have an effect on the metals. A lot of times the metals were left in place if you remove the organic contaminant. So no, you just had an individual technology. Then later we actually proposed what we called combined technologies. It seemed to take favor, and so now the fact that it's not really favorable to leave metals in place, and we've gotten a lot more information on metals, that you can put several technologies there. For instance, a physical separation to take out particulates, and then turn around with maybe some type of extraction technology, a soil washing technology to treat the fines, okay, the particles. So yes, but there again, it depends on your particular site and the conditions and how much money you have, et cetera.
All right. Well, I think in the interest of time, we're going to move on to our next presenter, but I did want to thank you very much for joining us today. If participants have additional questions, or perhaps you were in the middle of typing something up for Professor Bricca, you can continue to send those questions in, and then if we have time left over at the end, we might circle back. So, Professor Bricca, if you can stay on the line with us, I'd appreciate it, and we may come back to you at the end of our session today. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and call up the next presentation and get ready to turn things over to our second speaker, who is Mike Truix, who is joining us from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, where he is a senior project manager there, and he's been there since 1992 doing remediation research in field applications. Mike, if you are on the line, feel free to come off of mute and feel free to begin your presentation.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jean. I'm happy to present today, and what I'd like to talk about is sort of the process of remedy selection and implementation for radionuclides in soil and groundwater. And I kind of want to focus on the type of factors that I think are important, and primarily thinking about those sites where you may need to consider contamination that may have to stay in the ground, and how do we manage that. And so that's a concern at some sites because certain techniques are difficult to get extraction. So how do we go about that process of remedy selection and implementation in those sorts of instances? And I'll use the U.S. Department of Energy Hanford site as some examples, but my goal is really to have the discussion be more generally applicable, but those are the types of examples I'll use. And in doing this, in presenting this material, I'd kind of like to sort of build from the bottom and then move into this. So I kind of want to talk about radionuclide characteristics and how those are related to this remediation and remedy selection process, and then also think about end states and natural attenuation and how that relates to our remediation decision. So I'm going to do a little bit of introduction on those sorts of elements and then get into the example of how we kind of think about all those things together in terms of remedy selection and implementation. And so kind of starting with our radionuclide characteristics, they all have different types of properties, and those are sort of either our friend or our foe. And so, when you think about half-life, typically, that's how fast a radionuclide might decay to something innocuous, and generally shorter would be better. So you might have that as an impact to think about, where for things like strontium-90 or tritium with relatively short half-life, that's going to be kind of a different dynamic than things like uranium iodine or technetium-99 that have very long half-life. So we have to understand that factor of the characteristic for that radionuclide. Mobility is sort of another interesting characteristic that's important, and that's what what you classically think of the sorption, or how it interacts with the sediments and how that relates to how fast the contaminant moves in the environment. And of course, there's different factors for that. So low mobility might generally be thought of as good because the contaminants may not have moved and you may have them sequestered in an area where you can get at them and use some of these more direct extraction sorts of technologies. If you have sort of medium to high mobility, that can be good or bad. You know, it's good in one sense if it has a lower mobility because maybe that means the transport is attenuated and that plume might not migrate as far, and you can use an attenuation sort of approach as part of your remediation. But if you're trying to extract that through something like pump and treat or some other mechanism that relies on mobility, then you're fighting that. And, of course, any type of interaction with the sediment is something we have to really consider in terms of secondary sources. So we may have disposed of a contaminant. It may have moved somewhat during that disposal period, and now we might be worried about that secondary source, those contaminants that are accumulated on the sediments because of lower mobility, but yet not low enough that they can still leach out and create continuing plumes. So these are some of the characteristics we need to gather about the contaminants we'll be concerned about for a given site. And then, of course, another aspect are biogeochemical interactions. So what kind of reactions are important in terms of the chemistry of these materials? And so sometimes that can be helpful. So uranium and strontium actually interact really well with phosphate materials and create low solubility precipitates. They also uranium also interacts with silicates and with the same sort of effects. So that can be of an advantage if we think about how that might turn into a remediation technology. But some other interactions are, again, sort of a mixed bag. You know, uranium and iodine and actually chromium interact with carbonate, and so they'll form some precipitates which are sort of still moderately soluble, and so that can be good in some ways where that may be an attenuation mechanism to slow movement of a given contaminant, but it may also lead to creation of these secondary sources. Transformation in terms of changing between different chemical species can be helpful or not. And so iodine, for instance, is actually present in a couple different species in the subsurface. It can be present as iodide or iodate, or it can complex with organic compounds. And redox sort of reactions where you have an oxidation reduction reaction going on changes those species, but none of those species are really completely sequestered or tightly held with the sediment. So that sort of reaction is only moderately helpful, only if it leads to a subsequent step that may be helpful to the remediation. Similarly, with uranium and technetium, the oxidized species are typically mobile. The reduced species are typically not, but redox may or may not be something that you can control in the long term in a site, so you need to think about that. So, again, all these characteristics need to be understood in terms of whether or not they're going to be a friend or foe to what you're trying to do at your particular site. And the one other part I wanted to emphasize about this is it's not just the contaminant chemistry that's important. It's the context. It's the other geochemical setting. And so the example I use for that is actually the disposal chemistry. So depending on the type of site that's out there, the contaminant may not have been disposed as a pure chemical. It's going to be disposed with some other components. And so at the Hanford site, we had disposal chemistry that was very acidic and some that was very alkaline. And for uranium, that makes a big difference. So on the left-hand side of this slide, what you'll see is if you have an acidic disposal, that acid is going to start being neutralized when it hits the sediment. And during that neutralization, what happens is you actually dissolve some of the sediment. That's how neutralization occurs. And you're going to dissolve carbonates and phosphates and maybe a little bit of silicate. And then what happens is as that solution now becomes more buffered towards a neutral pH, you'll get some precipitation. And some of that can pull out some of your uranium. For instance, uranium phosphates can form. So in that process, the chemistry of the disposal actually impacted the distribution of my contaminant and then its subsequent further movement through the soil. Now, you've also thrown a lot of other solutes into solution, and that may affect the sorption behavior. So you have both positive and negative effects that you have to think about. For an alkaline situation, same thing happens. You get neutralization, in that case, primarily from silicates dissolving, and you get uranium silicates that might form. So these sorts of things are all part of the contextual information that you have to think about when you think about radionuclide characteristics and how they affect what you're trying to do. And so that all really comes together when you develop your conceptual site model. That's where you bring all these pieces of information together. Here's an example of a conceptual model components that we thought about for iodine that was disposed at the Hanford site. So you can see that we had to think about the inputs or the waste disposal characteristics. We had to think about what happened in the vadose zone as that material moved through the soil, what sort of hydraulic factors or reactive facies might have been important. And then, of course, as we get into the groundwater, similar sorts of things. What sort of reactions might have happened? What are the hydraulics? What sort of water chemistry do I need to be concerned about? So those are all components that give you this context of how you think about what might be important for the remediation process. And the one sort of danger in kind of thinking about all these little pieces is that really we need to synthesize that, and we need to think about which of these processes are really controlling and of most importance for what we're trying to do. And for that, I really think you need to kind of take a step back and think about the broader picture. So we've kind of talked about what type of site data you might have in terms of discharges and those source terms and developing this conceptual site model. And that was a sort of static conceptual site model that I showed you on the previous slide. And what we found is that you really need to think about the system as dynamic and the whole system and how that contamination is moving and therefore what you need to do about it. And so for that, we found that actually applying some of the approaches that are out in the really good natural attenuation guidance that's out there, those guidance approaches really have you focus on what is affecting the movement of these contaminants in the ground, because that's all a part of whether or not they're going to move to a point of concern or be attenuated. So if you apply that sort of assessment, then you can refine that conceptual model in terms of quantifying what does that transport look like and how does that relate to whether or not these contaminants will reach points of exposure or how they might attenuate over time and reach ultimate, for instance, beneficial use goals. And that process then helps you define, well, what is my risk, and therefore what would be the end state? How much of this material do I have to get out of the ground, and how much might be able to stay in the ground and still meet my goals? So that comes down to then determining your remediation strategy. And the cornerstone of that is determining, well, what's happening already. So that's your natural attenuation component. And that may be enough. That may be your full remedy. It may have very little impact. And you may need to really think about what sort of active remedies are going to be needed. Or you may be sort of in the middle ground, where attenuation is helping you in certain ways and helping you focus where you need to really apply, for instance, an enhancement that's then going to be able to allow you to meet your overall goal. So I think the main point of this first part of the presentation is to say, think about those characteristics, but think about them in the context of the chemistry and biology of your system, and then think about them in the context of what does it mean in terms of how things are moving, and how am I going to then wrap that into what I want the end state of this site to be. So that's all sort of a starting piece that we can now think about when we look at the process of remedy selection. So I'm going to go through some examples here and kind of talk through some things I think are important. And again, use the Department of Energy site as a case study. And I'm going to focus a lot on this idea of attenuation and transport processes, because again, to me, that's the way that we kind of pull this all together and think about what the system looks like now and how we might need to change it to meet our goals. And I think the other important thing I want you to think about as we go through this is this idea that remedy technology decisions really relate to a number of different things. One are those radionuclide characteristics. The other is the target problem. And so that, again, is the context and how things are moving. And then we have to layer onto that the different types of functionality that a specific type of remedy might have. So this says, well, does it affect the hydraulics? Does it affect the chemistry? How does it change the system to meet our goals? And then, of course, that all has to be thought about in the context of our remediation objective. So I want to walk through these components and kind of hopefully give you a way to synthesize these together and the way that we've been trying to think about this, for instance, at the Hanford site. So just to give you a little background so you know some of the things we have to think about here at Hanford. This is just a slide that shows the type of things that happened at Hanford. So fuel elements were manufactured, so there was a lot of uranium processing that occurred down in our 300 area, and so the character of the waste is related to uranium and also the chemistries that were used during that manufacturing process. up along the river were where the nuclear reactors were located, and fuel elements were irradiated. So that there were types of discharges associated with that, and another character of type of contaminants and also chemistries. And then in the central part of the site here in what we call the 200 areas of the central plateau, they did chemical separations of those fuel elements, and that's where they extracted the plutonium. And so there we had a whole different nature of chemical processes being used, so a lot of different types of chemistries in terms of what was included in discharges to the environment, and also a lot of different types of radionuclides, because now we're extracting and trying to get plutonium, but there are a lot of other radionuclides that go out in that waste stream as we did that separation. And so that gave us the context we have to think about now when we're in the environmental restoration portion of Hanford's mission. So the other part about Hanford to think about is, so this is a picture of some of the groundwater plumes that emanate from those central plateau or those central processing sites. And you can see the scale here. So this scale length is about 5 kilometers. So these are very large plumes. And what the reason we have large plumes is there was a lot of water used during operations that went with these wastes. And so there's a big driving force. And so that pushed the contaminants through our vadose zone and down into the groundwater and created some rather large plumes. So that's part of the environmental legacy we have to clean up, or is what was pushed into the groundwater during operations. But not all of that contamination got to the groundwater. We have a pretty thick vadose zone, and so there's still quite an inventory here. And this is just an example of some of the technetium-99 and uranium inventory we have at different areas within our central processing zone. And so because some of these materials are still in the vadose zone while we have groundwater plumes, we also have to think about the future of this vadose zone contamination and its potential to continue to contaminate the groundwater. So those are a couple things that we're going to talk about here in the next portion of the presentation. And as a context to think about, we have out at that, especially at that central processing area, we discharged waste at the surface. Some of those wastes, you know, were put into tanks. There have been just releases that maybe did not yet reach the groundwater. And like I talked about, there are some releases that pushed the contamination all the way to the groundwater. But we still have to think about both this residual and the current groundwater plumes when we think about these conceptual models. So again, here's sort of a recasting of all these factors we have to think about. And again, this is sort of a laundry list, and that's not how we want to go about our remedy selection and implementation process. We need to be focused and think about what are controlling these sorts of movement of contaminants, and therefore how do we mitigate that. And so instead of thinking about that laundry list, all those are components we need to be that might be important, but we're going to think about the vadose zone more in terms of if we had a waste discharge, we know that now we've got a source or an amount of contamination in the vadose zone. We know that it's movement through the vadose zone is attenuated, and what we want to know is, well, how does that process occur? Because we're interested in this flux to groundwater and how it related to this resulting plume. So if you think about that as sort of a transport process and natural attenuation, you might think of, if you didn't have a vadose zone and you just had a source in the groundwater, you think about the source, you think about the source flux, and then the plume that's created and how it might be attenuated. For us at Hanford, where we had a discharge at the surface, we have these first two pieces that are kind of linked together and happening in the vadose zone, and then we have this groundwater attenuation and plume movement that we have to be concerned about. So that's kind of a first step, is thinking about, well, what is the context of my problem, and therefore how am I going to have to think about what the controlling factors are? And again, for us at Hanford, we have to think about some of these controlling factors in the vadose zone. So what do we need to know? Well, a primary factor for us is figuring out how do we quantify what that contaminant flux from the vadose zone to the groundwater is. That's going to tell us, is that source a problem or is it not a problem? Is enough attenuation happening in the vadose zone that we're not going to create a plume of concern? And then we also want to know where contamination might be, and therefore that might help us focus where mitigation efforts would be of most use. In the groundwater, we're really thinking about this idea of what are the current plume dynamics and how that might occur and how those dynamics might change in the future, and what might those secondary sources be? Do we have some compounds that might have gotten into the groundwater and are now associated with sediments that provide us secondary sources we have to work on for cleanup? And if we do something active, you know, we started this whole thing kind of talking about thinking about the attenuation processes. Well, if those weren't enough and we had to apply something like an active remedy, then the question is, well, how much do we have to do to diminish that contamination until we might then be able to allow attenuation to be our final part of our end state in terms of reaching our ultimate goal. So that idea in the groundwater of thinking about that process right up front is important because that helps focus how we need to think through what's important for us to understand about the site. And then while I've talked about vadosone and groundwater sort of independently, of course it is a coupled system like we talked about on that last slide. We need to assess those continuing and long-term sources. It's not just the current plumes. It's going to be that whole coupled system. So as we again think about building that conceptual model, building our site understanding, and thinking about staying focused on what's important, part of that is going to be thinking about a coupled system. So again, and the reason for that is we have these enormous plumes, right, and we do have to do some work to try and mitigate those and think about what's appropriate to diminish those, but we have these remaining sources. So we have quite large amounts of mass still remaining in the vadosone, and we have to think about that whole coupled system in this process. So now let's talk about, well, what sort of information do we gather? How do we think about this? And so what are the processes that are important? Well, we're going to have to think about hydraulic processes because as water moves, there's dispersion, there's dilution, there's processes in the vadosone in terms of how water moves, in terms of mixing, and those are going to all be important. So we need to know something about that. We talked about sorption, so how does that relate in terms of contaminants reacting with or interacting with the sediments? Transformation, what sort of reactions might change the species or the type of chemical species that you have for a radionuclide? And then how does that relate to how it might be sequestered, for instance, in a different type of precipitate that may have a different mobility than the previous form? So these are all things that we're going to have to consider, and the reason they're important is because we need to understand the source flux, and how that relates to what might be created in terms of a plume. We're also concerned about the inventory. Now, you might think, well, you know the inventory because that's what you dumped in the ground. Well, that's true. We kind of know what we dumped in the ground to some extent. But what we're interested really in is that inventory of contaminants that are still going to be mobile and relate to groundwater plumes. So as I'm going to talk about later, there are some of those chemical reactions that might have happened right as part of disposal that might have sequestered some of those contaminants in pretty immobile forms. So we need to understand the inventory of mobile contaminants. And, of course, spatial distribution is important because that's going to be related to where we're going to target our remedy efforts. And then, ultimately, plume dynamics are going to control how we think about the groundwater system, which is sort of, in this case, what I'm talking about in terms of the ultimate receptor and what we need to think about in terms of restoration. There are goals we have to think about for the vadosone, but in our context at Hanford in particular, we're thinking about the vadosone as a key concern relative to its source to groundwater. So how do we protect that groundwater? So you hear me emphasize that a lot. There may be other drivers at some other sites, but for my presentation, that's sort of the context I'll be talking about. So let's now start first talking about the vadosone, and I want to give you an example. We've started characterizing the vadosone at Hanford, and so right up front, we thought about what do we need to include in our sampling and analysis plan. So the sampling and analysis plan tells us what do we target for this characterization effort. And what we've done is we've said, all right, we need to think about what are the important hydrologic units in my vadosone that are going to be factors that might be important for controlling how contaminants move. What are the representative contaminant discharge? Do I have to think about acidic conditions or alkaline conditions? And at Hanford, we have a number of different discharges. So how do I go about and think about that chemistry and what I have to characterize for that specific type of site? And then what do I know about problematic waste sites where I know that I had either a lot of different chemistry going on or very high concentrations or very high discharge volumes? And so what am I have to think about in terms of that characterization? So that's it. That helps give us a context for targeting what we do in our sampling and analysis. And then what we did is we looked at a series of different types of analyses we did, again, to focus ourselves on what we need to know in order to best understand what controls movement of contaminants and how fast they might move and how that relates to source flux into the groundwater. So part of that is thinking about the contaminants of concern and their concentration and the chemistry that we now see in the groundwater, or in the vadostone that might relate to how they move. We use techniques like sequential extraction and other indicator diagnostics because it's not just about the total concentration. We want to know how the contaminant is distributed between aqueous phases or phases that are in sort of different levels of association with the sediment. So these sequential extractions I'll talk about, first we apply some water to the sediment and we see what kind of contaminant concentrations come out when we extract with water. Then we'll apply different levels of more harsh extractions, and that gives us some information about how contaminants are distributed between aqueous phases less and less mobile sediment phases. And then, of course, that gives us some information about contaminant distribution, but we also want to know how does it behave, and that's where we can look at doing some quantitative analyses in terms of leaching tests, where we might put soil into a soil column and flow water through it and see what leaches out, and we can quantify that and get sort of the kinetics of that process. Or we may do a sorption test, so what we might call batch KD studies, where we contact sediments with contaminants and see, well, what's the partitioning behavior of those. So now we're, again, looking at quantifying the characteristics that are important for defining transport. And then also we need to look at hydraulic and physical properties, because those will be a part of studying this. So let me give you some examples. We've kind of talked about this in general terms, but here's some examples of the type of data we get from these experiments. And so here's some sequential extraction data, and so this is for a number of different samples that we withdrew from the vadostone. And here are the different type of extractants we use. We use groundwater. We say, well, what comes off when we put groundwater in contact with these sediments? And then after we did that, now we're going to apply an ion exchange solution. And then we're going to apply different pH acetic acid solutions sequentially, and that's going to dissolve, for instance, some of the carbonates or maybe some of the iron oxide. And then we'll apply even harsher acids like oxalic acid and then nitric acid. And what we see is here's the character, for instance, of uranium that comes out in these different extraction solutions. And what you might notice from this is that only a small fraction of the total uranium came out in just the water. So this is a really mobile phase uranium, but it only is present as a small fraction of the total. And then you see some others in this particular sample that's associated with, in this case, carbonates. And what you see is of this total uranium that's present in the soil, a lot of it is sequestered in pretty immobile forms because when we leach it, only a small amount actually comes out in the leaching. Primarily that was associated with this aqueous phases or sort of this first sort of carbonate phase for uranium. So that's important to know in that, one, that changes our inventory of uranium that's mobile, and it also gives us some information about, well, what's the material that we have to be concerned about for leaching to groundwater. The same thing actually occurs with iodine. So here's iodine in the soil. You might think of iodine as iodide or iodate, but it reacts with carbonate, and actually we saw that. So here's the mobile phase iodine, and here's the phase that's associated with carbonate and iron oxides. And again, you see very low levels of leaching, yet a much bigger inventory. So this is important for us to understand in terms of looking at that source in the vadostone. So this is an example for uranium and iodine where we saw some of those attenuation factors that are very important to us. Here's technetium-99, which is typically present as protectinate, which is an oxyanion, and all of it came out when we contacted it with water and the ion exchange solution. So there's not much attenuation of technetium-99 occurring, so that gives us a different target when we think about remediation of technetium-99 versus uranium or iodine in the vadostone. So that's why we do these experiments, is to give us that information that helps focus our remediation. Here's another example for uranium that just shows you how that profile of sequestration of uranium might change with depth. So here you see, and this is fraction of these different components. So again, you see the fraction of the mobile components actually are much higher lower down in the vadostone, which you might expect because that mobile phase is moved deeper. And then we have these less mobile phases, a lot of this yellow material up top. But look at the numbers of the total uranium. So these are fractions, but the total uranium in these first two samples are 690 and 387 micrograms per gram. And then we only have tens to less than one lower in our profile. The reason that occurred is because up here, because we also disposed an alkaline solution at this particular site, a lot of that uranium's been changed into uranium silicate, so it's no longer as mobile, and so much less to travel down deeper in the vata zone. We also see that in other folks have looked at this in terms of kind of characterizing non-mobile and mobile phases. And again, you can see it's the inventory in your non-mobile versus your mobile, and that helps you decide on your targets for what do I have to do with this in terms of remediation and how much has attenuation helped me. And here's just one other example where we looked at, in this case, chromium, although both uranium and iodate also interact with carbonates. But here we had an acidic discharge, neutralization of acid releases a lot of carbonate, but then further down in the profile, that carbonate's going to reprecipitate, and it does incorporate chromium in this case in that carbonate. And this is an example where here's a sample from a Hanford field sediment. This is actually down right at the groundwater interface. And so the problem is now we have this material that was generated during disposal, and it is actually a secondary source for us now because this material is not completely immobile. It's not completely insoluble. It will dissolve slowly over time, and that's what we have to now manage is the fact that we have this secondary source. So that's something we have to account for when we think about the remediation for this particular site. So those are some components of sort of the chemistry that we have to think about in terms of radionuclides or metals and then how that might relate to our remedy decision. But we also have to kind of know where they are. And so in some cases, they might be only in a small portion of the vadosome because only a small amount of liquid was discharged and there's not been much movement since then. In other cases, you might have different zones of the vadosome where you have different concentrations or maybe different chemical reactions happened in the green zone versus the yellow zone. But we still need to know this overall distribution of where things are located so we can then think about the chemistry information along with that. So typically, you know, you drill boreholes, you get samples. That's how we do the chemistry. During the drilling of those boreholes, you might also do some geophysical logging to look at spectral gamma logs or neutron logs to look at where the moisture is. But we think, and we've been applying now, it's really important to think about these in three dimensions. So one of the ways we've done that at the Hanford site is to look at electrical resistivity tomography because that essentially shows you where the higher conductivity material is. And a lot of times, waste materials have higher conductivity than in the surrounding native background material because discharges like the ionic solutions that came with that waste are higher conductivity. And so for us, nitrate is a big signal for us. And so here you see a view where we have these different features, these tanks and these trenches and these crib fields. And then what you see down below them are here's actually images of the plumes. So now I can actually see where the water moved and where the nitrate moved. And I know that's the path that my discharge went on its way to groundwater. Now that's of nitrate and very mobile constituents that light up that signal. Now, that doesn't mean that uranium is all the way along that path, for instance, because uranium sorbs to the sediments or may react and be slowed, but at least now I know the outer hull of the path where those contaminants might be located. So that helps us when we decide where to drill. It also helps us to think about sort of the magnitude of the distribution of contaminants within the vadosome versus how they might behave in the future in terms of a groundwater source. So that's another component that we add into how we think about vadosome sources. So I've kind of walked through some of those chemical and sort of larger scale factors that we think about in terms of building our case for how do we select a remedy in the vadosome. But, you know, in the groundwater, we have some of the similar things we have to think about. So here's the same sort of thing we did with uranium in the groundwater. So we grabbed some sediments. So here's a bunch of different sediment samples. We did the sequential extraction procedure. And here again, even in the groundwater, there's still reactions that went on that sequestered some of this uranium in less mobile forms, but there's still leachability. So now we're in the groundwater, and actually the movement of water now is much greater past these uranium materials that are in the sediment, so they're going to leach off. And here's an example of how much leaches. And so that's an example where we have a secondary source. We have to think about, well, it's good that they that uranium interacts with the sediment, but in this case, it's giving us a secondary source. So that attenuation actually is something we have to think about in terms of, well, how does that relate to, for instance, how well we can pump and treat this unit, or how it might relate to a continuing source that then drives how this plume will diminish and the type of attenuation we see out in the distal end of the plume. The same sort of characterization is now being applied in different hydrologic setting, but it's important for how we now are going to go about and select the type of remedy that's most appropriate. So I'll give you an example of that. So here's where in the 300 area, so if you remember, this is where we did uranium fuel manufacturing. They discharged some waste to trenches and ponds, and so there's uranium contamination that went out with that. They actually dug up a lot of those old discharge areas, but there's still an area where they couldn't dig underneath those facilities where there is still uranium in the vadose zone. And at this particular site, we're fairly close to the river, and the river seasonally goes up and down, and so that changes the water table. And so seasonally, we have water that moves up and touches this uranium contamination that's still in the vadose zone, and then that can flush it out into the groundwater and be a continuing source for our plume. And so what we'd really like is if this uranium were less mobile, then every time the water came up, it wouldn't grab so much uranium to flush down into the water table. So that might be a strategy for remediation, is to make this uranium less mobile to decrease that source. So that indeed was a strategy we thought about. So we went back to the chemistry that might do that for us, and reacting uranium with phosphate creates low solubility conditions for that uranium. Uranium sorbs very well to phosphate and actually can form some uranium phosphate low solubility minerals. And so here's an example where we took some treated sediment with phosphate and we put it into a soil column and ran water through that soil column, both for a treated sediment and for an untreated sediment. So a couple things to notice about this. One is it doesn't make the leaching zero. That's very hard to do, but you see that the leaching rate of this is basically a low and steady rate. So what that means is every time the water would come up and touch this sediment, only a very small part would come of uranium would come out with that, and therefore we keep our concentrations of uranium very low. You'll note with the untreated sediment, you actually eventually get to that same state. See, this slope here is the same as this slope here, but the bad actor for us is this near-term uranium that's still in mobile forms, and that's what the phosphate treatment did for us. It took this material that's still mobile, and it created less mobile forms, so now when the water comes up, it can't pull this material out quickly, and the uranium concentrations stay low. So that's an example where we're kind of thinking about the context of where the uranium is, how it gets contacted with water, what chemistry might make sense to help us achieve our goals of keeping the uranium concentration in groundwater below the MCL. So I've kind of walked through those sorts of examples. I'm going to move into some things we might do as we start thinking about evaluating different technologies. So a lot of times we think about doing treatability tests or different other types of assessments and think about the characteristics now of the remedy functionality, but always we have to think about it in the context of these other factors. So we'll talk about just a couple of quick examples. You might think about soil flushing or surface barriers and desiccation or uranium sequestration. I'll just give you those examples, and hopefully they'll be kind of constructive of the types of things we think about when we look at technology evaluation. So kind of going back to our diagram here we had before, if we think about soil flushing, so this might be an idea where we know we have contaminant distributed in the vadose zone, and we might say, well, if we can flush this and push that contaminant down to the ground where we can capture it and then get it out of the system, that might be one way to treat this. But what we have to think about goes back to what we did in terms of characterizing the site. So if we characterize the site and we know that some reactions already occurred with that maybe sequestered uranium because of a disposal chemistry or because of interaction with sediments, or because we might have hydrologic layers that slow uranium movement, those are things that are still going to impact us if we try and flush that contaminant out. So if that's the situation, then flushing might not really be very effective because it's going to be fighting all those things that actually help sequester the uranium in the vadose zone, whereas we might have another site where maybe we didn't have so many of those interactions, or maybe we have a contaminant like technetium that doesn't really have those interactions. Maybe in those cases, we would be more successful in actually moving contamination here into the groundwater and capturing it. So those are some of the factors that kind of build off that information we collected earlier and inform us in terms of whether or not this is a reasonable technology to pursue. So, well, let me go back one here. So the other thing we might think of is maybe if we had a condition where uranium or other contaminants were sequestered to some extent in the vadose zone, but maybe not enough for us, we might have to think about putting a surface barrier on with the idea that if that lowers the amount of water that flows through the system, that will lower the flux of contaminants into the groundwater. And that would be a remediation technique. So how would that work for us? Well, here's some example of how we thought about that. So here's an example site where these represent technetium 99 distribution in the VEDA zone underneath three different cribs. You can see different discharges led to different distances that the technetium has moved. And if we left that technetium alone, here's some plots of what would happen. So if you just let recharge water migrate through the VEDA zone and push that technetium to the groundwater, you'd see that over time, over several hundred years, we'd get about 140 curies of technetium that moved into the groundwater. And you see that here in terms of the flux rate, you see this pulse of flux over the next couple hundred years. And why that happens is because there's still water moving through the system. So here's the water that's draining in through or going in through the system. This is part of the water that used to be discharged, and now here's the water that over time is the natural recharge rate. If we put a cover on top of this, the effect of that is to now we're going to drop that recharge very low. So now that's going to be less water moving through the system, and you see that drops the total amount of discharge to the groundwater and keeps this flux rate low, but you notice it couldn't stop all of it. And the reason is because there's still some water that was down below in this system that's still going to drain out before the effect of this surface barrier takes effect. So if we can remove that water by desiccation, which is basically blowing in dry air, evaporating that water, creating dry conditions, now I can really limit the amount of contaminant that moves underground my groundwater. I've really reduced that flux rate, and the reason is because I've much more rapidly dropped off this water to reach my low recharge conditions. So that's a case where we looked at this overall hydraulic system and said, how do we affect this to reach my goal, which is to slow down the rate of movement of this material so it never gets above a groundwater concentration of concern. And we had to think about all those attenuation mechanisms and transport mechanisms and the remedy functionality in terms of would this be something that might work for us. So here's another example, and this is kind of similar to there's a lot of different ways that we might sequester uranium, for instance. So phosphate might want to be one of those techniques that I talked about earlier, but in the VEDA zone, it's very difficult to move phosphate because it's a liquid form. Well, one thing we looked at was if I still want to sequester that uranium, maybe I could move a gas. And what we found is we can move ammonia gas through the system. It partitions into the water where it becomes ammonium, and in that process of protonating, it creates high pH conditions, and that, like we talked about, will dissolve some of the sediment. What it dissolves is primarily silicate, which come into the solution, and then as that pH decreases because of buffering and because you've got ions in solution, now I'm going to create precipitates, which will include things like uranium silicate, which are not as mobile as the type of uranium I had previously. So now when I compare the leaching in a soil column, so I put the soil in a column, I run water through it, untreated, I get this sort of continual release over a couple hundred pore volumes. About 80% of the total uranium in that sediment came out. When I treat it with ammonia, I didn't make it zero, but now look at how much flatter that curve is. And so what we have to think about is, did that chemical change where I reduce that leaching rate, is that going to help me reach my goal in terms of reducing the flux to groundwater and staying below the treatment standard we have for groundwater? So that's where we take a chemical reaction like this, and then we think about it in those larger terms in terms of transport and impact on the groundwater. So those are a couple ways that we might think of evaluating how a technology might work for us and the types of things we think about. Now we'll look at the types of targets and how we're now going to move to implementation. So we have to think about, well, where are we going to apply this? So I talked a little bit about that in terms of where the chemistry might have happened or where the contaminants distributed, what chemical form we're in, and then we really have to think about how much do I have to reduce that flux if I can really meet my goal if I'm going to do something where I leave contaminants in the ground. So that's kind of a comparison to if I need to do some extraction. In terms of in the groundwater, we might think about similar sorts of things, but there we might think about, well, do I have to diminish a current plume? How much do I have to diminish it? And what is the impact of my secondary or continuing sources in that whole process? and in my long-term solution, and how does that relate, for instance, to transitioning to M&A? So this whole sort of coupled system then gets us to think about how do I consider current plumes versus long-term sources when I go out and now I'm going to implement some remedy, having gone through characterization and these sorts of selection processes that I talked about. And the thing that I think is important that we're now using in terms of selecting or implementing remedies is, in many cases, while it might be nice to think about a plume where you say, here's my plume, here's what I know about it, and here's my remedy, I'm going to go out and boom, I'm going to be done. And sometimes you have a sort of a simple situation where that might happen, but many times if there's uncertainty in how different remedies will work, and you may need to think about multiple components to a remedy or maybe staging it in time, and that is what we call an adaptive site management strategy. And that was really something that came out when the National Research Council looked at the status of groundwater contamination and remediation and said, hey, you know, there's a lot of sites out here that have tried some remediation and they haven't been fully successful because the system has some complexities or challenges, and they might really need to think about doing more of an adaptive approach where they implement one technology that reaches a certain goal, and then after they reach that goal, they think about, well, what would be this next step that I could go one step closer to my ultimate goal of, or my ultimate end state? And so the National Research Council talked about that, and there's recently been an ITRC, or an Interstate Technology Regulatory Council, is a group of state regulators. They produced a document recently called Remediation Management of Complex Sites, and so it talks a lot about what I just talked about in terms of understanding your site, thinking about what's going to be important to doing your remediation, but then also recognizing that you might have to take steps to do that remediation as opposed to just pick a remedy, apply it, and boom, you're done. That doesn't always happen. So this is a really nice document that kind of talks about those processes, and it's available now. The other aspect that has been coming out recently is kind of thinking about this idea of we may need to go out and apply active remediation. For instance, to diminish a plume, and pump and treat is an active remedy that's been used for that. And then the question is, well, how much do I have to diminish that plume, and how do I think about criteria for how I might stop active remediation and transition to M&A, or maybe transition from pump and treat to some other type of remedy that might be more appropriate once a plume is collapsed to a secondary source, and now you can just attack a smaller area that's a secondary source with some other technology. So there's also some guidance out there now that we've written relative to developing those exit strategies and thinking about that transition point. And the last thing I want to kind of talk about is I've talked about remedy selection and remedy implementation, and we've talked about chemistry and behavior of contaminants and how we might go about this process. But one big aspect of that relates to that whole process is monitoring. And monitoring is something that gives you information during characterization. You know, characterization shouldn't be thought of only taking a sediment sample and finding out what's there. You have to also monitor maybe your groundwater and think about, well, how are things changing over time? And you need to target that to have a certain objective. You know, what am I trying to find out? How do I monitor that? And how does that feed into me better understanding my site? Once we go to select and implement remedies, monitoring is very important to integrate with that remedy because we really need to think about performance metrics and how we provide ourselves feedback on the course of remediation, especially if we're going to be thinking about adaptive strategies. Because an adaptive strategy, say, I'm going to take a step, I'm going to see how it works, and then it's going to inform me into my next step. And so monitoring is very important for that. And then, of course, transitioning from maybe an active to a longer-term strategy, we need to think about monitoring and all those purposes. So I can't tell you all about monitoring in this presentation, but I couldn't do the presentation without emphasizing that that's a very important component of this overall process. And I'll just give you sort of one example. And this is a strontium 90 plume at Hanford. And so back when the discharges were occurring, there was a lot of water that got discharged. And so see this outline of strontium 90 here, the plume that was created. And you note that plume is a lot higher than what the current water table is. And that's because a lot of water went in here, and the water table was higher during discharge. And there was a big driving force that moved this strontium 90 at that time. Well, now, with this much lower water table, there's not as much driving force for that strontium 90 to move, and strontium 90 decays over time, about a 30-year half-life. And because it moves slowly and decays fast relative to that movement, most of this plume here is going to decay before it reaches the river, but not all of it. So that's why we installed an apatite barrier, which is a type of phosphate which interacts with strontium. And so that helps control the flux to the river. So that's part of a remediation strategy where I have something, a permeable reactive barrier here, and then essentially attenuation back in the plume. And the way we monitor those different areas is different. The monitoring here back in the plume, this is a process that's going to change over a fairly long period of time, so we can look at sort of snapshots in the plume of the plume over time, maybe at fairly long intervals, because this is really not changing very rapidly. Whereas here at the river, we may need to consider performance metrics that are much more closely tied to the dynamics of the water movement and the dynamics of this treatment process, so we might have to apply a little more intense monitoring. And the whole idea is that we need to link that monitoring to the type of remedy approach and provide feedback, one, in this case, on the performance of that barrier. Is it performing as we want it to? And back here, we're looking at the performance of longer-term natural attenuation processes. So, again, it's this whole idea that we need to couple that monitoring with our overall remedy process. And so, like I said, it's not a monitoring presentation, but I can't do this presentation without mentioning monitoring. And so in conclusion, I just kind of want to go over some of the areas that I tried to emphasize. And so the first area was, you know, while we kind of think of classic characterization in terms of contaminant concentrations and nature and extent, it's really, you know, how is that contaminant moving and how is it behaving in the environment? And really there's some really nice information that we can borrow from the natural attenuation guidance documents and think about those and methods in terms of characterizing attenuation and transport and how that relates to this remedy selection process. And that remedy selection process, those decisions, are really the intersection of a bunch of different elements. So we need to think about characteristics, target problem, functionality, and objectives. And so I tried to provide some examples where I emphasized how you kind of integrate all those factors into deciding how to proceed. And then, of course, this last part is when we go to implement, again, emphasizing this idea that with many of these sites where, you know, it's not going to be something that we can just dig up and haul away and be done with it, where we have other challenges and maybe a larger plume or different challenges with applying an extraction technology, we may have to think about adaptive site management where we take a stepwise approach. And that's an important sort of new area that's being emphasized, and I gave you some references to documents about that. Exit strategies are part of that because that kind of thinks about this idea of I may need to do something active in the near term, but in the long term, maybe I'm transitioning to either some different type of active remedies or maybe natural attenuation. So, again, an important consideration that you should think about up front because you want to plan for what you're doing as opposed to just reacting to, for instance, a remedy failing. You want to be thinking about, well, maybe that should have been thought about as a first step, and I planned that to do a certain action, and I know I'm going to take a next step after that. And then, of course, like I just emphasized, monitoring strategies are really important to integrate into this whole process. And so, again, while we're not talking about those in detail, that folds into everything I just talked about in terms of giving you good information on a temporal basis, right? You get temporal data when you monitor over a period of time that really helps you understand the dynamics of the system and also your remedy functioning. So anyway, hopefully I've kind of given you some picture of the types of factors I think are important as we look at sites for remedy selection and implementation, and I'd be glad to take any questions now if you have some. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much, Mike. I'll remind our live audience that if you have questions or comments on this presentation, you can enter them into the Q&A window in the bottom right corner of your screen. I know a few of you were raising your hands electronically in the webinar. If you didn't do that, don't worry. You don't need to know how to do that. Just a quick reminder that we ask our attendees to type in their questions or comments. We don't use the raise hand feature. So with that, let me start with the first question, Mike. And I think you were just hitting home on this concept. And that was that one participant wanted you to talk more about the, quote, monitored portion of M&A. And I think you were just discussing just how significant it can be in that whole remedy picture. Are there other resources perhaps you might point people to if they want to learn more about the monitoring element in M&A?
Yeah, that's a great point, and I agree. Monitoring is very important. It's important for a couple aspects. Well, you know, one, of course, for things like M&A, of course, that's your cost element, and you need to think about how you do that monitoring and how you manage the cost for that, and then what information you need to get from that monitoring that helps you understand the dynamics of the plume and attenuation. And there are some good resources out there. I think the EPA's M&A guidance is really excellent. I use that all the time. There's also been some other sort of monitoring technology resources that are out there, and there are the DOE has put out a document that talks about monitoring strategies, and some of those more recent documents are talking about, you know, a lot of times we think about monitoring in terms of monitoring wells and collecting samples, and of course that is important, but there are some other monitoring technologies that are starting to emerge, and I talked about one of those, the electrical resistivity tomography, but there are other technologies and also approaches that are important that help you manage the cost of monitoring, but also help you focus in on the information that's most diagnostic of the dynamics that are occurring that are important to the remedy management. So I have actually I have a bunch of references that I included in my slides. I don't think I included some of the monitoring ones, so I apologize for that, but if you go out and do some searching or if you send me an email, I'd be glad to help with the type of resources I use in terms of thinking about monitoring. So thanks for the question.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Our next question says, in the example of treating uranium in the vadose zone by applying phosphates, is there a concern of further impacting groundwater with unsequestered phosphates?
Well, that's a good observation. So in any type of remediation, you have to think about secondary effects of any amendments you're going to use, and typically you're weighing that against the benefit that you gain from sequestering uranium, for instance. But you have to think about those secondary effects, and if there are ways to mitigate those. So for the sequestration we talked about, it's not broadcast over a large area. It's a hotspot sort of treatment, so that sort of limits the amount of phosphate sort of impact. And we actually did some work to look at the fate of phosphate. And this technology was applied in a sort of a sequential fashion where we did treatability tests and then up to a sort of a first stage of implementation. And we're just now actually looking at the second phase of implementation. So it is a very important factor, and almost all amendments have some type of secondary effect. You know, even a bioremediation substrate has a secondary effect of reducing the subsurface, and therefore you can cause other reactions to occur that aren't directly related to contaminant sequestration or degradation. So it's something we have to think about for everything. I'm glad you brought that up. I did not talk about that in my presentation, but perhaps I should have. It's another factor when you think about technologies is, you know, what is the total chemistry or hydraulic package that you get when you apply that amendment? So good question. Thanks for pointing that out.
Okay, thank you. I think somewhat similar to that, you had brought up a point when you were looking at the uranium and that you had portions of it that were mobile versus some that were non-mobile. And one participant wanted to know, you know, even if you have non-mobile uranium, didn't you still need to address that if it was posing a risk?
Yeah, that's correct. If it is in a location that is still imposing a risk, then that is correct. So maybe what I'll do is I'll use the example. For uranium, I talked about the uranium that we see in the groundwater at that example site where we did some sequential extractions. We still see uranium in these sediment-associated phases. And that's not completely immobile, right? It's going to leach over time. And so that is of concern because it is still a risk because it may create uranium contamination in the groundwater above levels of concern. So that we'd still have to address that secondary source material. So that mass of uranium is still a target for remediation. In the VETO zone, if you don't have a direct exposure pathway, so if we're in a deep VETO zone situation where really our exposure pathway is just a groundwater impact, if I have a uranium in a form like a uranium silicate that is relatively immobile, so it has very low leaching characteristics and is never going to put uranium out into the pore water at a very high concentration, and then that low concentration uranium is never going to create uranium above a level of a risk in the underlying groundwater, that's a different setting. Now that might say, well, maybe that uranium is already sequestered or attenuated and is not a risk. So it depends on where we're talking about, but it is a good point. You can't just assume that only the aqueous phase is the risk. It's the aqueous phase and any of the precipitated phase that's still leachable enough that it creates concentrations above a risk level. So, yes, that is correct. That's a good clarification. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. And you were just talking about the VETO zone. So this question, or participant, wants to know more about the blow-in dry air through the VETO zone. Can you expand on that concept?
Sure, yes. So that's at Hanford, we have a relatively thick VETO zone, about 75 meters thick. We're in a fairly arid site, so the natural recharge is fairly low. But when we discharged water to the VETO zone, it got wet. So a lot of moisture went into the VETO zone. And so some of that pushed all the way through the groundwater. But even if it didn't, there's still residual water that's sort of draining into the groundwater at a rate that's higher than if you think about a desert, right? So we've added water to the VETO zone. Well, one of our technologies that we've actually tested out here, and we've got a number of publications on, is to blow in dry air, and that will evaporate that water. The water then essentially evaporates and becomes humidity, right? And so that humidity moves out away from that zone where we've injected the dry air. The water doesn't recondense unless it hits some area of different temperature. Because during evaporation, the desiccation zone cools, we're always moving from colder zone to a warmer zone. So essentially that water just stays as humidity. It moves out away and just moves out into the larger zone. It doesn't contain any contamination. But what we've done is we've dried that VETO zone. So now when I put my surface barrier on top, I don't have that remaining water that's just going to drain and carry my contamination into the water at a high rate or at a rate higher than I want. So that's the basis of the technology. There are some reports, and I think I might have included some of those in my list of references. If I haven't, I'm certainly happy if you send me an email to provide those. It looks like I did include the report. It's this PNNL 26902, so there's a lot of information about that technology in that report. So anyway, that's the quick version of how it works.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much. I don't see any other questions in the live queue at the moment. That doesn't mean we won't have one or two more come into the queue. But I think perhaps in the interest of time, we're going to go ahead and go back to our sort of overview introductory material. And I'll let Cindy Frickle, if you're still with us on the line, perhaps we can advertise to the audience some of the upcoming FRTR-related events and wait to see if we have any other questions come into the queue before we close out things today. Cindy, are you there?
Yes. Thank you, Jean. I just wanted to point out that we do have a second session coming up based on the last FRTR meeting, so second webinar session. That will be 1 month from today on March 28th, and that session will cover incremental sampling methods for remediation of heavy metals, application of an in-situ activated carbon amendment for sediment and soil mercury remediation, and we'll get updates on remediation research from NIH's National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. There, the link that you see here is for signing up for that webinar, just like you did for this one today. And we have one other thing I'd like to point out. There is an in-person meeting for FRTR coming up on May 9th. This will be held at the Reston, Virginia, USGS headquarters. The topic for that meeting will be evolution of subsurface remediation, lessons learned from technical challenges to achieving cleanup goals. And webinar participation will be available for those who are unable to make it in person. And I just want to thank our speakers again, and I'll hand it back over to Jean, see if we got any more questions.
All right. As I suspected, we did have one more come in. And so I'm going to read this question out loud. I believe, Mike, that this question is directed to you. And this participant wanted to know, how does radium fit in with the monitoring risk assessments and remediation of other radionuclides?
Well, I think what we're referring to are maybe naturally occurring radioactive materials, and so at many sites that is actually a driving factor. I have to admit I don't have a lot of experience with that. At Hanford, we have plenty of anthropogenic sources and that overwhelm those sorts of considerations for us. So unfortunately, I don't have a lot of experience with that, although I do know that there is quite a bit of literature on that topic, and also related to NORM or naturally occurring radioactive materials out there. So I apologize, but that's not really particularly what I've had experience with.
Okay, well, I appreciate the information regardless. I don't see any other questions or comments in the queue. So I think I'm probably going to go ahead here and essentially walk through just a few final reminder items before we close things out today. What I want to do while I have you here, again, don't hang up or leave just yet, just a couple of quick reminders. A few of you did ask if you could have copies of the presentation material. I just wanted to remind everybody that is available from the seminar resources link. So if you look on the middle right of your screen, you should find a series of URLs in a box called related URLs. Simply scroll through that list of links, click on the one that says Seminar Resources, and then press the Browse To button. That will allow you to open up that website and access the materials that were presented today. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, guess what? Those links still work in the archive, so you can go ahead and follow those links and click on the buttons to access our materials. Contact information for our presenters and organizers can also be found on the seminar homepage. And feel free to write me if you have a specific question or comment or suggestions for future webinars. And then I will ask if each of you could take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form. There were nearly 150 individuals who joined us from all over the world today. We had participants from as far as the UK and even some American attendees from Alaska. So thanks very much for the widespread. If each of you could follow the link to the seminar feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content that we presented as well as the method of delivery, we would very much appreciate it. It helps us to continue to offer these types of sessions through the Cleanup Information Network. One of the most frequently asked questions I receive is if we issue CEUs or PDHs. While we do not issue those for our sessions, we do offer participation certificates. Many people are able to take those participation certificates along with their registration email and or copies of the materials from the session and use that as documentation to verify their attendance to still get credit from whomever their accrediting organization is. So if you want one of those participation certificates, you can get one by filling out that online feedback form. At the bottom of that online feedback form, there will be a box that, as long as you check that box, which says that you certify you were there for the entire live event or replayed the entire archive, when you check that box and send in your feedback form, you will immediately have access to one of these participation certificates that you can either print out or save for your own records. If you participated in a group, each person can fill out that feedback form on their own and then get their own certificate, even though you attended on one computer. So if you're replaying the archive, you still can follow the link to that feedback form and let us know what you thought to get one of those certificates. So today's session was recorded. You will automatically receive an email once the archived material is available for on-demand playback, and you're welcome to forward that on to other colleagues that you think will find it useful. As Cindy mentioned earlier, this is the